So for those of you who weren't here last week I talked about the word, Pali word, sada, which we discussed a little bit what the best translation to English could be. And it's usually translated as faith. Some people insist that that's a poor translation, and it's better translated as confidence or conviction. So I want to build a little bit on the talk from last week and say that whatever this sada is, faith, confidence, it's considered to be a very important quality to have for people engaged in Buddhist practice. But faith is not meant to be an end in itself. It's not supposed to be something that you have, like a faith in a belief system or something, and then you can just rest on your laurels. The function of faith in Buddhism is to be motivating. So to motivate us to engage in the practice, motivate us to live a certain way. And with the long-term idea that as you live a certain way, as you do a practice, that practice then informs you, teaches you, shows you, opens up areas of understanding for you, so that the faith you had initially becomes knowledge. And so there's a movement from faith to understanding, faith to wisdom. And then it said that someone who had made that movement, sometimes it said that person is faithless. And I guess faithless is usually a bad associations in English. But in Buddhism, when you follow that path to the knowledge part, then you no longer need that faith. You no longer need confidence, because you've already, you've attained the understanding, the knowledge that you need to have, the freedom. And there's a variety of places where faith, the sada, confidence, has an important place. And one of them is in the description the Buddha gives on how to be a student. He doesn't use any kind of word like label, but how he describes someone as a student, engaging the teaching. And the first step is to have some faith or confidence or in the person who's teaching. And so just like you would, I said this last week, just like you would if you're going to learn a skill, a craft or a musical instrument or something, you have to have some confidence, some trust or some faith that the person knows the skill, knows the instrument, and has the ability to pass it on. So same thing with Buddhism. Buddhism is learning a skill. And so to that degree, you have to have some confidence in the person who's going to teach it. And so the Buddha actually encouraged people to check out the teacher. And don't kind of naively kind of grab onto a teacher because the teacher has credentials and whatever. But check it out. Check out the teacher out. Have maybe a wary eye towards the teacher, and find out whether their behavior somehow accords enough with what they're teaching, with the basic values of Buddhism, that it makes sense for them to be teaching. And then once you've kind of checked the person out and have some confidence in the teacher, then you have to listen. Now, in the ancient world, they had no books. So nowadays, a lot of people don't listen, they read. And so they read these books by great teachers. But then it's interesting that after reading or listening, the task is to reflect on what you've learned. So rather than just taking it verbatim or taking it blindly as being the truth, the idea is to reflect on it and engage in a kind of contemplative reflection, or some kind of use your intelligence. Consider what you've learned. Consider what it means to you, whether you can be behind it, whether it makes sense to you. So we have this movement of faith, of confidence, that allows you to open up and listen. But once you've listened, then you have to use your intelligence again to question what you've heard. And so you question the teacher before you listen, and you question the teachings after you listen. So you reflect on it. And part of the function of reflection is to make it your own, is to understand how it applies to you rather than some abstractions not there. And it's a wonderful process, I think, to engage in some teachings and then kind of make them your own or find out how they kind of incorporate it into your life. And as there was a long period of time when I was living in Zen monasteries where I would read about a paragraph a day, or maybe a page a day at the most, of a Buddhist book. And that was enough for me. I felt so full from from the teaching, because the idea was to then try to see how those teachings apply to my life. And I didn't want to take a lot more. I'd get indigestion if I read too much. All these ideas, how do I handle all this? But I could, one paragraph or one page a day I could handle. And then I would spend the day kind of going over what I'd read and thinking about it and seeing how it applied in my life. And there's an active process of engagement. So faith is not an end in itself, but it's kind of the beginning of a process of engagement and a process. And then after the reflection, then hopefully you come to some point to what the tradition calls reflective acceptance. Through your reflections, you've come to some degree of acceptance of what you've learned, what you've read, what you've studied, and what you thought about. And acceptance doesn't mean that you're now kind of a blind follower, but you accept it enough. So these teachings, so now you can, you're going to try them out. Now you're going to engage, you're going to practice it. So if you know, want to learn a skill, sometimes we get these things at home where I have to assemble them. And there's instructions for assembling. And I've learned that it's really important to read those instructions. So I've learned reflective acceptance of the value of reading the instructions from learning the mistakes and not doing it. Well, I know how to do this. And then, so some kind of acceptance. And then there's a process of engagement and engaging oneself, having the motivation and the zeal. The Buddha talked about zeal. It's a great word, zeal. Great enthusiasm for trying it out, for doing it. So the Buddha said someplace, he said, the Dharma is not for the lazy. Isn't that interesting? So I guess most of us are ready to leave now. Leaves me out. The Dharma is not for the lazy. And the one translation I saw recently for this passage, then he says, it's probably not a... I'm going to go back and look at the original, but the English translation says, it's for the industrious. So I don't know about that word, but for those who can engage energy and engage in the process. In the Zen tradition, they have this wooden sounding board that they use for calling people to the meditation hall. It's a square, it's a rectangle, but maybe 3-inch thick or so piece of wood, and has this big wooden mallet, and they hit it against that. You hold it with a rope on one end, and it's hanging from the ceiling rope, and you hit it really hard, and you hit it, the pattern of where you hit it to call people to the meditation hall. And usually it's written, traditionally it's written on that wooden sounding board. It's written, life and death is the great matter. Practice as if your hair is on fire. And so the person who's calling everyone to the meditation hall is hitting that slogan. So you get to see it. So practice as if your hair is on fire, which means don't waste time. It ends. Life and death is a great matter. Practice as if your hair is on fire. Don't waste time. So that's interesting. So faith, the function of faith is to inspire, to evoke action, activity, to follow a path, a practice. And so we have in Buddhism this very important metaphor of the path that we follow. And the idea of a path can be kind of expanded on, the metaphor can expand in a variety of ways. It's a very rich metaphor. And one way is that if you're in the woods, and I've been in some woods where once I wasn't in the Amazon jungle, and I went about 10 feet into the Amazon jungle away from the river we were at, and I realized very quickly that if I went any further, I had the risk of getting lost, because there was no distinguishing characteristics. It all looked the same. All the trees were the same. Everything seemed so much the same that I would get disoriented very quickly. The canopy was quite thick, and I'd lose track of which way to go to get back to the river. And so, you can go. You can be in a wooded area, and if you don't have a path, it's possible to get lost. You don't know which way to go. Or you can come to a wooded area, and there can be many different paths, and you don't know which one to take. And you might take one that takes you in a direction you don't want to go. So, or maybe it's a direction you do want to go, and you take many years on that path in the woods, only to find out that it wasn't such an interesting goal after all. So there's a path of monetary success. Some people are on that path, and they spend years. Major preoccupation is making money. Or there's the path of status, or the path of safety. Years. People spend years and years looking for safety. That's the path they want to be on. I'm fond of a little saying that goes, a ship is safe in the harbor, but that's not what ships were built for staying in the harbor. So each of us, we're safe, we can make ourselves safe, but maybe that's not what human beings were made to do, is just to be safe. So people can pursue safety. That's the path they look after. Or there's a path of relationships. People looking for the right relationships. And people spend a long time looking for relationships that will fulfill them, make their life complete. And some of these paths, people are able to go to the end. And sometimes they're wonderful. And sometimes their wonderfulness, or the lack of wonderfulness, at some point getting to the end, they realize, well, there has to be more. There's more to life than this. Now, I made a lot of money. I have a great relationship. I made a lot of money, but this relationship is a disaster. This relationship is great, but the money thing didn't work out. It's all kinds of combinations, right? There's some people, nothing works out. And so some people then end up frustrated. The paths don't work out at all. They keep looking for new paths and looking for new paths, and none of the paths seem to work for them. Whether you realize there has to be something more than the path you're on, or the path is frustrating, or whatever, didn't promise the happiness that you thought it would, some people look for other paths. And so Buddhism offers a path. And for some people, this idea of a path becomes very important, because it gives their life meaning. It gives their life a sense of purpose. It gives an orientation for the life. Oh, this is the path. This is what, in terms of what I'm going to intend for my life, what's going to motivate my life, what's going to orient my life, I'm going to find my bearings in this life, this path that the Buddha taught, that's going to be the path that I want to be on. Now, you don't have to be on the path. There's no obligation to do it on it. But for people who want to be on it, you shouldn't underestimate the tremendous power that has in their lives. Why I like the word faith as a translation for sada rather than confidence. Because faith, I think of faith as that which you want to base your whole life on. The values, the beliefs, the orientation, the path that your life's really going to be about. And so confidence somehow doesn't seem rich enough or deep enough or heartfelt enough. And the unfortunate word faith does. For me. So the idea of a path, and if you take a walk on a path in the mountains, there's many ways in which, attitudes or approaches you can make to walking a path. But there's two that I think are maybe helpful in looking at the Buddhist path. One is the idea that the point of the hike in the mountain is to get to the destination. And so you walk as fast as you can. You're fixated. The scenery around you doesn't really matter. What's important is where you're going to go. And another approach is where you're going. Destination is not that important. And you're definitely going somewhere. You don't walk on a path without going somewhere. But what's important is the walking itself. Each step along the way, the scenery, the enjoyment of the process. The process is important, not the destination. And you find Buddhists who do both things. They focus a lot. Some Buddhists focus a lot on the destination, and some people focus more on the process. Some people focus more on the immediacy of each step, each moment. And some people focus more on what's possible in the future at some point. And I think that, and then there's sometimes arguments, inter-Buddhist arguments, about who has the true Buddhism. The people who are into the immediacy school, just now, here and now, immediate. Or the people who say, no, it's about huffing and puffing and eventually building up enough inner strength and stability and concentration and mindfulness and things. And then eventually something will happen. You mature, have some realization experience or something. And I like to think that actually both approaches are not only complementary of each other, but they are mutually necessary for each other. That it's very helpful to have some sense of a goal of what Buddhist practice is about. And then it's very helpful, I think, to have some sense of the immediate fulfillment of practice, fulfilling aspect of practice in the moment. I've known people who have focused on a goal and had no sense of fulfillment or satisfaction in the moment of practice and ended up being more and more frustrated in the practice because they're always trying, expecting, hoping for something in the future. And I've known people who have focused so much on the present moment without any goal that they didn't realize that they were on a different path than they should have been on. You know, if the moment is most important, then, you don't notice that there's a different fork in the forest and you took the wrong fork. You just didn't engage in the process. So the Buddhist path is, I think of as being very wide. So the idea of a path in the forest is usually kind of narrow and tight. But I think of the Buddhist path as being really like a huge, huge, you know, multi-lane highway, really wide. And why it's important to think of it that way is that being really wide, it's very accommodating for all of us. We don't have to change ourselves so radically. We're not asking to kind of fit into some narrow groove of what it looks like to be a good Buddhist, but rather we're trying to take some basic principles and finding how is it that we can take those principles and fit them, work them into our life, so that our life can be that path, moving along that path. So one of the first things that is important in engaging the path, and the first thing you need to listen to very carefully, is what is it all about? What's the orientation? What's the view? What's the purpose of the Buddhist path? And you have to listen very carefully, because your job is to see, does this make sense for me? Is this something that you want that has value and importance for you? And how does it have importance for you? Maybe you want to give benefit and doubt to Buddhism, that they say this is important. So maybe rather than dismissing it right away, maybe you want to engage in a debate with it and explore it and get to know it and say, well, what is this about? One overarching way of talking about the Buddhist path is that it's a path that leads to happiness. And it's a path that leads to a happiness that's stable, that's lasting. And what Buddhists like to say, it's a happiness which is unconditioned, meaning that it's a happiness that's not dependent on the conditions in the world. And as long as our happiness is dependent on the conditions of the world, then the conditions of the world, when they change, then our happiness is changed also. It's not so stable. So kind of the overarching idea is happiness, the idea of some kind of lasting happiness, stable happiness, well-being, peace, for ourselves, but also for others, as being a goal, the direction. And then a little bit more specifically, the goal is understood, that happiness is understood to arise with liberation or freedom from clinging. And this can seem very like a small goal for a great world religion to have. Freedom from clinging. The way you find the path in Buddhism is by having the compass for finding the path, the compass of finding your way. The basic compass is two questions. The question is, where is the clinging in this experience? What's going on now? Where is that clinging? And where is the freedom from clinging? Where's the happiness that comes from let go of that clinging? Where's the joy? Where's the peace? So where's the clinging and where's the release? So if you ask those two questions in whatever experience you're in, whatever's going on in your life, then you can find the path. That's how to find the path in what's happening. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to change what you're doing. But if you want to find the path in what you're doing, you ask those two questions. Where's the clinging and where's the freedom from it? And the premise being that it's possible to be released from clinging. So why is that important? The analysis in Buddhism is that our suffering comes from our clinging. And that is a very challenging teaching. I hope that you reflect on this like you're supposed to. No. I hope that at least a few of you are offended or troubled or disturbed or anxious when you hear that your suffering comes from your clinging. At least some of you are troubled by that. Wait a minute. You know, well, this makes some, it makes sense some places in my life, yes, of course. But my boss, you know, my boss did this thing to me. And how, I'm not responsible for what my boss did to me. This horrible thing happened to me. I had this car accident this weekend. It's, you know, it was terrible suffering. I'm, you know, my clinging responsible for that suffering of the car accident? What do you mean, Gil? The path in Buddhism is found when we look at our contribution to our suffering. Our contribution, so the clinging that we contribute to it. So our boss gets angry with us, does something horrible, and then it's all kinds of, we can cling to all kinds of things as a result of that. It's maybe unfortunate, the fortunate event, but perhaps it's your pride which got hurt. And you have, it's very important to be seen in a certain way as being a smart or capable coworker, and somehow the people around you are not seeing you that way. Or I'll give you a story from when a Buddhist teacher's story of clinging. I went to up to see Ajahn Amaro at his monastery, Theravadin Monastery up in Ukiah, with a group of other people. And the custom often when you go to a monastery is you bring something to, as a donation. So we were going to bring lunch or food, make donation of food. And all my friends came along and brought food for that lunch. And I knew there was going to be a lot of food for lunch, so I brought this dry goods, like, you know, beans and rice and stuff, so they could have for, over the week, because sometimes people didn't visit them during the week. So they don't have food for the week so they could eat. And so, you know, I was happy enough with what I did. I was happy. And but then it was time for lunch with the monks. And the way the lunch was served was we're all sitting around in this kind of circle in the room, and the monks served themselves first, and the dishes get passed around. But as the food is carried into the room, the cook or the kitchen people announce who has given that food, that dish. So it didn't take long for me to realize that my name was not going to be spoken. Because my, you know, my, I didn't make a meal for that day. My food was for, my donation was for days, you know, in the future. And so I could feel inside of me this upwelling feeling. But let me tell you. You know, my reputation, how people saw me. Let me tell you. And so my, I was clinging to something. I was clinging to how I was going to be seen by people, clinging to some reputation, being seen. And I'm a Buddhist teacher, after all. I should know better. I should, you know, whatever, you know. Making. So what's our contribution to our suffering? And this very challenging thing that Buddhism suggests or says is that that you are responsible for your suffering. You're not responsible for all the unfortunate things that happen to you. But those are unfortunate things. They are uncomfortable things that happen. But the suffering is when we take these conditions of the world, and by our clinging to it, our heart or our mind contracts, clings, gets hard, gets tight, gets smaller, goes on fire, does something, starts spinning, gets agitated. And so in order to look at that, we have to kind of, so to find the path, we look at that. In order to look at that, we can't be blinded by blaming other people. It might be, it's very important. Sometimes Buddhists have this problem of not looking at other people's problem, situation, not speaking up and confronting people, because Buddhists are so internal sometimes. So you should be warned. There is a time when you speak up. But the thing in Buddhism is you don't want to get blinded by blaming other people or being upset with the conditions of the world. You want to kind of look and see, what's going on inside of me? Where's my clinging, my resistance? Where's my grasping? Where's my aversion? What's happening in me? And that's when you find the path. If you're not interested in doing that, then, you know, if you're not interested in the path, you don't have to do that. Now, it's very beautiful, I think, this simple movement of where's the clinging and where's the freedom from it. Because it has an immediacy to it. That it's something you can see right here and now at times. Sometimes it's so glaringly obvious in this moment, you can simply let go of your sense of being in a hurry and relax. And right there, here and now, there can be a feeling of relief, of release. It can be as simple as, standing in the supermarket in line and getting impatient because the person in front of you is taking too long. They bought too much food. And, how could people be interfering with my life like that? Those people buy so much food. And so rather than doing that, blaming them, to find the path, we turn around and say, what's this impatience in me? What am I clinging to? And then can I release that? And maybe in something like that, we can find it right, right, very simple. And it's quite beautiful sometimes, the immediacy of practice, what we can encounter. And there's so much depth in the present moment that an opening up, a letting go, a softening of a preoccupation, you can get a sense of kind of great stillness or depth or boundlessness or spaciousness that's available right here. It doesn't have to be very far away. But it takes a while, not so easy for people to discover that, if their mind is caught up in the world of thinking, preoccupation, always thinking about something. And I think it's really hard, really, really hard for human beings who spent decades thinking or feeling their emotions, and they're orienting their life around their emotions or their feelings and all that. It's really hard to step out of that, to experience themselves, experience reality, without, not through the filter of words, of thoughts, of feelings, but by stepping out of that, to experience that there's this peace or this spaciousness or this vastness or this depth or this love that's here as well. And the analogy is given in Buddhism is that of the monkey mind, that apparently these monkeys are just, they grab onto one branch, and then before they let go of that branch, they swing over to grab the next branch, and then the next branch, and the next branch. So the mind sometimes works that way, just constantly going out to the next idea, the next thought, the next conversation, the next thought, kind of grabbing one after the other. And so some people who live their life completely in their thoughts, even if they're connected to the world, they're basically present, their orientation to the world is through what they think about it. And I like to think of that as that's a life that's about. That's an about life. The thoughts are always about something. And if you're living in your thoughts, the thoughts are always about something. It's an about life. And so if you pay attention to your thinking, how you think, one of the things you start discovering is there's clinging in thinking itself. And probably most of you had some sense of that during the meditation session, because probably most of you weren't able just to push a button and stop thinking. And some of you probably let go of your thoughts only to have them to reappear. There's this tremendous momentum to think and desire to think and sometimes obsession to think, that there's a big process of meditation to let go of. And the value of that is we can drop out of a life that's about, always somewhat removed from life. So when we start getting a sense of how deep and tenacious the clinging is, it has to do with even how we think. We can take one step further and look deeper than that and see that there's also clinging to a sense of self, clinging to a self-identity. And some people hold that the self-identity clinging is the deepest clinging that people have. And that the ignorance around self is one of the primary ignorances. And that the deepest movement of Buddhist practice or the path is to liberate ourselves from the very subtle clinging to self that can exist. So other people say it's other clingings can be very fundamental as well, the clinging to being alive or the clinging to want to die. There's a variety of clingings that are very deep in people. And so when you start appreciating how deep some of this clinging is, then the path is not necessarily fulfilled in the moment. You can't just let go of these deep things immediately. And so then there's a sense of a direction, a sense of a goal. Oh yes, it's possible to develop my mindfulness, my concentration, my inner qualities, my inner good qualities. So I set the conditions, create the conditions, the appropriate conditions. So at some point, I have the strength and the flexibility and the insight to let go of these deeper forms of clinging. So in that regard, the Buddhist path is also something that takes time. And it takes patience, it takes energy, it takes engagement, it takes resolve, dedication, to engage in it. And that's where, for some Buddhists, when they appreciate how very, very deep the clinging is, clinging to self, and they have a sense of the possibility of a happiness or well-being or an engagement in life that's really free of that clinging, that becomes for them the most important thing that they want to do in their life. And somehow that becomes the primary thing that their life is about. And so their life then becomes not about living a life and then including Buddhism as part of it, but rather it's practicing Buddhism and orienting their life, including their life, into that Buddhist practice. How to do that? So the path, the faith in the path, gives a life meaning and purpose and direction. And the sense of direction, I think, is very important here. And some people will find that it's helpful for them to walk that path, that direction, for a short while. And there's plenty of people who find it very helpful to be on the path for a few months or a few years. And then somehow their life is settled enough, they've let go of enough, or they've found themselves enough, discovered themselves enough, that then they go and do other things in their life. And some people will stay on it, you know, maybe for their whole life, because it becomes the thing that their life is about. So the function of faith is to stimulate a person to action, stimulate a person to do something, to act. Not stimulate a person to sit and, you know, be a... There's a term called nightstand Buddhist. Or another way of saying it is that there's this beautiful path in the woods, really beautiful path. But there's also, you know, a bookstore in there. And so you go in and get a stack of books. It's great, you know, stack of 10 good Buddhist books. And you sit yourself down against a tree in the woods. And the path is right there. And you're reading, this is a great path. I'm really inspired by this path. This is fantastic. You finish the book. Yeah, this is such a good path. I'm really going to get into this. I'll read another book. And, you know, the path is right there waiting for you. And it's kind of silly, right? And just read and read and read. So the point of faith is not to inspire you to buy books, but the faith is to inspire you to actually do something. And so then the question is what to do. And it might be enough to ask those two questions and act on those two questions. Where's the clinging and where's the freedom from it? But then the Buddha offered 7 other steps besides those two questions. And some of those steps are kind of like the landmarks or the signposts in the woods that help you both find the path, but also to help you measure how you're doing along the path. Are you actually making your way along the path? So one of the signposts is right speech. And one way to find the path is to look at how you speak. And is there clinging in how you speak? And there's often a lot of clinging in people's speech acts. And are you clinging less with how you speak? Or are you starting to speak in ways that are kinder or truer or more honest? Our conduct. Is our conduct expressing clinging? Or is our conduct expressing freedom from clinging? And is our conduct becoming better? Is it more helpful for other people? And then another signpost is the quality of our own mind. Is the quality of our mind improving as we do this? Are we able to somehow let go of the way we use our mind, our hearts, that creates bad quality, kind of, you know, makes for greater suffering, makes for unwholesomeness? And can we rather help prompt or encourage those qualities of mind which are beautiful? So the beautiful parts of the mind kind of grow and develop. And those are signposts along the way. And then there's the practice of mindfulness. Are we able to be more and more in the present moment and really connect here to the present moment? Being in the present moment is how you find the path, is part of finding the path. And because this clinging thing only occurs in the present moment, that's how you can discover it, with being in the present moment. And the freedom from it only happens in the present. And then are you getting more concentrated? Is there a greater sense of stability, grounded, centeredness as you do this practice? If you do these things, follow this path, then your ability to intuit, to feel, to see, to experience freedom becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. It becomes something that builds over time. It becomes like snowballs, bigger, builds and builds. And you realize at some point that this long-term goal that you had for a great release or freedom was, in a sense, always here. That is not something that it's not a geographical path that's going to take you from here to Los Angeles or here to some place you're going to get to, but it's really a transformation inside of you, and the timeless quality, the great peace for quality of the present moment, has always been here, but now you've been transformed or changed, so that you're able to be aware of that or tune into that, to that phenomenal presence that is always here. So, I'd love to know what you think of that talk. And so, faith and action. Is that enough? Should we stop, or should we take questions, or what should we do?
I'd just like to ask you about the suffering that we feel as a result of compassion for others.
So I think we have to be careful teasing apart the different aspects of the word suffering, what in English we might call suffering. I think, compassion almost always arises from our being in contact with something unfortunate, being in contact with someone who's suffering. And when we're in contact with someone who's suffering, it's a generally uncomfortable experience. You're with someone who's, you know, you don't kind of just kind of smile and whistle Dixie because, you know, you're with your neighbor and your neighbor's, you know, spouse just died. You know, you don't. You know, it's inappropriate. It's not human. There's empathy, and one of the things that happens with practice for a lot of people is mindfulness practice. Is their capacity for empathy increases? You can actually, the barriers, the resistance to feeling other people softens, and so there's a greater sense of contact with suffering, which is uncomfortable. To say it in a kind of trite way, or maybe it's very unpleasant. But unpleasantness is not the same thing as suffering. So, the Buddhist word suffering is a translation of the word dukkha. And dukkha is that discomfort or that pain that arises because of how we cling. So, if a person becomes free of clinging, I think they actually have an increased capacity to sense and feel the suffering of others. But they're not going to be oppressed by that. They're not going to be a victim of that. And because they're not oppressed or a victim of it, they're more able and capable of responding and acting in response. If you feel like you're a victim of the suffering of others, then there's probably some clinging inside of you that you need to look at. So it's possible to tease apart then different, you know, if you use a colloquial English idea of suffering, we tease apart different kinds of suffering. And the suffering that we experience that comes from clinging, we free ourselves from. The suffering that comes from not clinging, but simply being humans in the world of the sea of humanity, that's something that, in a sense, maybe we even embrace. We're willing to be present for. The world needs more people who can be present for suffering.
There's some international events that have been going on recently. There are always international events, you know, what's going on in Burma, what's going on in Bangladesh. I mean, you know, it's just constant. And, you know, you just can't reach out to all those people, nor can you send food to all those people or be effective. So, you know, the result, I think, can be just feeling very sad for them.
Well, yeah, I think there's a healthy kind of sadness to feel, some regret. I think it's a healthy way. Oh, I'd like to be able to help, be helpful. And then there's a kind of sadness which is it comes from a kind of clinging. If we feel oppressed or weighed down by it, then or guilty because of it, then probably it represents some kind of clinging. And so practice, the mindfulness practice, is trying to tease that apart. And one of the things to look at is some people have a tremendous sense of responsibility for the suffering of others, and or a sense of guilt. It's up to me. It's up to me to save the world. The Buddha couldn't even save the world, you know. So the sense of responsibility is, you know, can be a tremendous suffering for people and kind of clinging. But one of the things I do with situations like that is, in a kind of way, I don't know if inspired is the right word, but I'm stimulated by these things. When I read these things and I feel my empathy, feel my concern, my wish for that, I realize I can't have an effect in all the things I read in the paper, all the things I learn about in the world, directly. But I'm motivated by those things to, if I can't do help out in some way with those particular things, then I'm motivated to try to do better here locally. And so I'm motivated to try harder with my own practice, to engage more, to do the inner work that I think is very valuable for people to do. And I'm also motivated more to do the outer work of engaging in the world. And so I've chosen to be a Buddhist teacher. And it's a big, big motivation of mine, not to be a teacher, but it's a vehicle for me to respond to the suffering of the world. And so this is the way I try to do it, is here in Redwood City. And so when I read about Bangladesh, I say it's really important. You know, what I'm doing is important. And I'm going to really try to do this here well. I can't do that over there, but I can do better, even better here. I'm always trying to do better. So I don't know. And if I can help over there, then I will. You know, but I can't do everything. So that's my reflection on this. I'm sure other people have other reflections that may be different, but... So, oh, one more, yes. Oh, two more. Some of you can go if you want. If you go quietly and realize you don't have to be hostage here. And I'll try to make my answers really quick. So,
I don't think. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't think it was a question that I had, but through these two sessions that we had. Sundays.
Yes.
And I experienced kind of all of it, all the phases of, you know, something happening outside of my life and affecting mine and then contribute to my clinging and my suffering and then releasing it. And it took approximately 2 years to come to that, to release it.
Great.
And what I have to share also that when you want to release that clinging, you use one day, the butterfly, how you come and become a butterfly. You are from a chrysalid and someone helped. the cocoon to open up and the butterfly couldn't fly. In reality, sometimes I think the clinging and try to release and trying to find different path is that moment of, you know, change, maturity, and transformation. And you can, of course, you cannot speed up the process. Right. So
it's a very good point. And I often tell people, don't be in a hurry to let go of your clinging. Don't let go of your clinging the first opportunity you have. You should first get to know it. First to study it, to understand it well. Because if you let go of things too quickly sometimes, they might come back. Or they come back in other ways. And so this idea of, if you open up the butterfly cocoon too quickly and help it out, it's not going to have the strength to fly. It needs to push against the filaments to become strong enough to fly.
And I wanted to add two more things. Like you use the word sadha.
Which word?
Sadha.
Last
Sunday. And we are using a lot of C lately, confidence and clinging. So that leads us to letter F, which is freedom. And my own meaning was centered, being centered with who you are.
Beautiful. So that's it. Thank you. So maybe we should stop. So thank you very much, and also thank those of you who are going to help with the temple cleaning. That's appreciated.